Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post Acute Care.
So good afternoon, everyone. This is FAM, the Journal Club. Today's date is November 4th, and we are going to proceed with discussing about the COVID impact and how we are navigating all the potholes. And our special guest today is Dr. Alfonso Gonzalez Rodriguez, and we're going to bring him in a minute. But before, I want to go through some of our state of the state items. You know, it's been a while since we spoke, I believe, since prior to our annual conference, and then want to go through a clinical highlight that an article that I found that I thought was interesting. And after that, we're going to roll it to our discussion, and we'll have plenty of time for open discussions. You are able to put your questions in the chat. We'll be monitoring the chat as well so that we can make sure we address all of your questions. So the first thing I want to start with is just an overview of where we are at. You know, in the United States, we're over 9.3 cases of COVID. And when we look at the total deaths in the United States, we're over 232. I believe the Worldometer has us a little bit higher as of now. When you think about where we're at globally, we are now over 47.5 million cases throughout the world and over 1.2 million deaths. So, you know, we know that we're in a third wave, and we've started seeing spikes in across not only this country, but in other countries. And now we're at a particular point in time where we are also seeing certain countries locked down for a month, certain cities and European countries locked down. So very interesting time. When we look at just the United States and where we fall at in guidance with the World Health Organization, apologize that this came out a little blurry, but there are 36 states that have higher than recommended positivity rates. And what that means is higher than recommended for reopening. As you know, most of our country is open. In the state of Florida, we have relaxed, I think, much of all of the guidance, allowing for some schools to reopen and have a virtual platform as well as in-person classes. And, you know, I don't know how that's going across the state or even for anyone who's in other states, but I will tell you, here in the county that I'm at, my son's school just closed down again because of an outbreak. So, you know, very interesting. In Florida, our positivity rate over the average of the last past 7 days has been 6.08%. But I did look at the Department of Health numbers this morning, and as of Monday, we were running a daily rate of 7.58% for positivity rates. So we're still seeing quite a bit of cases here in the state, the majority of them being in Miami. And we are still dealing with it, as we all know. I wanted to show you a view of what's happening in long-term care. This takes into account of SNF and ALFs, and I've shown this before. You know, when we look at the positivity rate within our SNF, we have seen a lower, much lower rate. You know, we're doing better than we were, and pretty much staying stable with a positivity rate of 0.56%, and for our staff, we're at a little over 1% for positivity rates. You know, one of the things that I appreciated when we had our conference was some of the different analytic sites. I think Dr. Randall shared this one with us, the COVID Tracking Project. And in looking at it, they are now reporting long-term care data. And what they reported as of October 29th is, even though there's less than 1% of the America's population living in long-term care facilities, we're accounting for 40% of the deaths. If you go to this site, there's also maps where you could look at the different states. Florida currently is has a percentage of deaths in long-term care of 39%. That means that of the long-term care deaths, of the deaths we had throughout the state, about over 6,000 of them were in the long-term care space. So this is something that's a very interactive map. I would encourage everyone to take a look. It is a way for us to look at data, and it lags behind what we see from the Department of Health and other sites like the Johns Hopkins site, but it is providing really good, interesting data, not only around long-term care, but around this healthcare disparities at COVID. So just wanted to just highlight an article that I saw within the New England Journal of Medicine, and there's a lot of literature still pouring in. This one, you know, we are pretty much aware of the mild and moderate symptoms of COVID. I don't think anybody's unfamiliar with that. But the reason why I wanted you guys to just note this article, it shows the data and the information a little bit differently. So we're able to look at the current infection in individuals, and then see more of the symptoms, the testing, and what testing is recommended, when is isolation. And I really love the way they looked at the pathogenesis of the disease and management consideration. So we're going to put this on our library, because it is really, it goes into a little bit more detail, and it provides an overview what we know of this condition. It also goes into detail about looking at transmission across stages of infection. So if you're in the pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic stage, if you are symptomatic or post-acute symptoms, it really does a great job of breaking down all of those stages. And this article acknowledges the fact that we have a lot of guidelines from a lot of different professional organizations that some are now outdated, some are changing quite rapidly. And it brings us to the conversation that I want to have with Dr. Gonzalez about how we are navigating all of the potholes that we see, not only with all of the professional guidance, but the guidance that we're getting from state and local government. So, Dr. Gonzalez, I would have you come on and introduce yourself to our audience. Yes.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Alfonso Gonzalez. Thank you, Dr. Dayan Cepeda, for inviting me to spend this time with you discussing such an important topic on these days. I'm currently Chief Medical Officer of Post-Acute Care for CFIM. We provide service in the Central Florida area. So we are in direct contact with multiple nursing homes, around 40 nursing homes in the Central Florida area. Also with assisted living facilities and everything that has to do with the post-acute care spectrum. So basically, we are dealing with the COVID challenges on a daily basis, dealing with the dynamics, dealing with all these issues that are coming out of the issue, because COVID, we consider it like an octopus. The center point is the COVID, but it has a lot of branches that comes out of it that we have to deal with them and try to, in a certain way, make processes that make sense and interact well with the other processes that are already in place.
Thank you, Dr. Gonzalez. So I wanted to talk to you first about if you can just go into detail about dealing with state and local guidance and the variability and the challenges of dealing with that as you're trying to adhere to it and practice in the nursing home and the ALFs and across the multitude of care settings.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, adhering to the guidance had been a challenge, and I think the main challenge to it, or the main point on it, is that they change frequently. We all know, I mean, COVID had been a virus that had been totally new for many people, even though we were dealing with other strains of COVID in the past, but COVID-19 in specific had been so strange in its behavior, in its expression, in its transmission, that we cannot say that nothing that had been said in the process was wrong, because at the time, with the information that we all had, it all makes sense. So we have been adhering to every step of the process. The problem is that once you have like your processes and protocols in place based on that guidance, guess what? Something new comes out and you have to kind of change everything. We have the examples of the mask. Wearing your mask there was a time that they were saying, okay, a cloth mask, it's okay to be used. There was a time that it was said like, no, cloth mask is not enough if you're working in the healthcare setting. But also we knew that at some point there were not enough PPEs at the level that we needed to take care of the patients. So it was like how to protect the vast majority of the population that you have inside the nursing home, including staff and residents, with what you have as a resource. So the adherence to these guidelines have been challenged by multiple things, including what I was mentioning, the dynamics of those guidance that have been changing constantly, the resources available to attach to those guidelines, the financial challenges, which we hear as medical directors of facilities and working with facilities that the institution is having in a certain time to be able to provide what is needed for the safety part of the patient's care. So if they have to take decisions on what to buy first and how to use it, I mean, all those things were changing. And those were cases that were building by building, company by company, like the main corporations that lead the nursing homes. They had to establish their protocols and inside rules based on those guidelines that were coming out. You were mentioning state and local guidelines. We also had the national guidelines that are also around it. And they'll follow kind of a trend, but sometimes they put the bar at a different level. And then it is like some people would come and challenge some recommendations that you might give, or you might even challenge some recommendations. And when you start a conversation, you realize that is that they're following kind of different guidelines from different institutions, very, very respected institutions. But as I said, everybody is adjusting the guidelines based on the information that is coming out. And we know that there's still information coming out, and we know that there's still going to be information coming out probably a month, 2 months, a year from now. So everybody trying to do the best have become a challenge because we are all following based on the information that we are receiving. So it's like, who's going to win the race to get all the final right answers? We don't know. So in the process, we need to keep walking. So we mm-hmm. need to kind of grab the information and kind of put all the map together so we can have a whole picture, because we are the experts on the field. We are the ones that people are coming to ask. So if we have questions ourselves, how are we going to explain it to the people that is coming? So what I do and I always recommend my colleagues is like try always to do the disclaimer that guidelines at the moment, that recommendations, processes, and protocols are not final. They are based on the current information that we have, because the list that we want is people coming 1 month or 2 months down the road, coming back and telling us like, hey, you told me to do this and then I had this problem, or you recommended to do this and this happened. So by keeping that transparency of, hey, we don't know all the information. Hey, we are doing our best with what we have and what we know. And for sure, we can tell you that we're going to do everything that is in our hands to keep your mom, your dad, your family member, your neighbor safe. But there's always challenges that we will be dealing with that we will not have the right answer immediately. Yeah. So that adherence is tough when you are adhering to something that is dynamic, But at the same time, those are the things in that specific time frame that the guidelines are in place that are going to be backing you up on the decisions you are taking in your buildings.
So it brings me to the next item that I really want to talk through, and that is around what we saw with nursing home visitations. We know that there was, you know, Florida had been doing this, formed a task force, and I think from FAM that we were pretty vocal because we were not included on that task force. But then we saw guidance come out from CMS where it spoke to essential caregivers and capacitive visitations. And in the recent weeks, we've now seen the state of Florida even go beyond that. So how are you and your teams managing the expectations or the new freedoms that the state has rolled out around visitations?
Well, that's a very interesting question and area of discussion, because we understand as clinicians and as team leaders for our patients' care that patient is not only comorbidities and medical conditions are being treated. We understand that there's a psychological aspect of our patients' care, that there's a social aspect in our patients' care, that there is a emotional state aspect of our patients' care that can affect sometimes even more than the comorbidities that are under control. Mm-hmm. So we are, let's start with that part. We are actually understand that there's a need to adjust that care, because our patients, we know that they're suffering. Our patients with dementia are getting more confused because they are not seeing their loved ones. Their patterns are being altered. And we all that work in the healthcare field that work with patients with dementia, we know that altering their normal, the usual pattern on a patient with dementia will contribute to make them more confused. So we saw that with our patients. We saw that our patients were eating less. Why? Because their condition started declining. They got depressed. They got anxious. They would start asking, where's my daughter? Where's my son? Even though they were seeing them through FaceTime, through any platform, that digital platform, they were asking, and when am I going to see you? Because for them, that is not a contact with their loved ones. They were not the technology era or generation. So for them, not having that physical contact is like, they don't love me anymore. They're not coming to see me. They abandoned me. So all those thoughts that are in our patients, we understand that are happening, and we're trying to work with them. But knowing that part, we know that we need to work toward that, facilitating that encounter with their loved ones, facilitating that visitation process. But we also know that the only way the wind is going to enter your house is if you open the doors and the windows. Mm-hmm. So by using that analogy, we know that the virus had never been totally closed out of the facilities, because we have staff coming in. But that's a risk that we cannot avoid. I mean, there's some risks that you can work with. There are others that you need to be knowledgeable about them and work with them as better as good as possible. With the visitation, we know that we need to facilitate that, and we need to look which is the safest way of the process. So what I've been telling to my facilities is, let's first look at our reality as a facility. We have the recommendations, we have the authorization from ACA, from the state, on facilitating the visitation and opening for our family members to come, for those essential caregivers, even to assign which tasks are they going to be assisting with their loved ones, which was part of the task force recommendations. But at the same time, how are we going to do it safe for our residents? So I tell my facilities, let's look at our environment. Let's look at where we are. Let's look at our county. Let's look at our surrounding facilities. Let's see how the dynamics are happening. We know that if your facility is located in a very high risk area, that the trend of COVID cases keeps spiking or hasn't been controlled, or there have been outbreaks in the communities surrounding your facilities, you know that you are at higher risk for that. So What we have been working with the facilities is like, first, what is the ideal scenario for our patients to be with their family members, decreasing their risk of exposure? First is open areas, ventilated areas. Second, try to keep distance between the family members and the patient, which is a challenge because they might tell you, yes, I'm going to comply, but hey, you're talking to a family member that hasn't seen their mom or dad probably since beginning of the year, that they have been heartbroken for months every time they talk to them over the phone or they see them and that their mom and dad starts crying because they haven't been in contact with them. So you're not going to be that police officer telling them, like, keep a distance. Everybody will know the rules. Everybody will know what are the recommendations, but you know that there's some exposures that are going to happen. You need to be kind of upfront with that and tell the family members, okay, these are the rules that we had implemented here at the facility for this reason. I mean, we are in an area that is high risk, and the least we want is your mom, your dad to get the virus. So we want to facilitate your encounter with her, but please help us take care of your mom or take care of your dad. Make them part of the process. I was reading on an article on a case in which the daughter transmitted the virus to the mom, and it was very interesting. Let me see if I can find the wording that they use. But it was something like the worst thing that can happen to a son or a daughter is to know that their mom or dad died because they transmitted a disease to them. And that I can attest. I mean, that I just thinking about it, it is a nightmare if you think about it. So let's make them part of the process. I know that people are very aware of the virus. I know they're very aware of what is happening. Unfortunately, we also have people that they will not really kind of engage with the needs of the virus until the virus touches them closely. And that is sad. I mean, it's like a TV commercial. How many people would be an acceptable number of people dying of the virus? If someone says, okay, let's say 50, what is those 50 are your family members? Oh, my family, my friends? No. Well, how many patients is in an acceptable number? None. So let's try to make it to none. We know it's not going to happen. We know that there is going to be a lot of patients that are going to have complications, aren't going to die, but let's make it in a way that we make sure that it didn't happen because we didn't do what we had to do to prevent it. That it happened because there was not all the things that we could have done.
And I think that's you know, a very good point. I really would love to read that article because I think that when you put it in that way where you have children and you don't want to pass it to your parents, I think it's also true for us as clinicians. We don't want to pass that on to our patients. We don't want to know that we were the vector. So it is a very interesting perspective. How have you handled the guidance that even if your facility is experiencing an outbreak, you could still allow for visitations? They just have to be outdoor visitations.
There has to be outdoor visitation, no contact, and what most of the facilities are currently doing here in the area is that they're creating kind of shielded rooms in which they can see each other, but then they have the communication through a phone, even though they're across an acrylic or they're across even a plastic wall, but not allowing them kind of to exchange droplets or anything by any means. I mean, your patients are not necessarily going to be complying with wearing a mask when they're with their loved ones or wearing a face shield. But if you have that kind of barrier between them, definitely. I mean, it's not 100% contact as they would like, but if there's an outbreak, at least they have the chance to see each other and to kind of be close to each other, even though they're not touching each other.
Now, let me ask about something that I think all of us are probably familiar with and just things that we have to deal with as the holidays come on. The leave of absence is the holiday passes, you know, those things that I remember so well as Thanksgiving and Christmas would roll in. How are we navigating around that the latest guidance that we can allow residents to go home for the holidays and then check back in, you know, a few days later.
Yeah, that had been a very, let's put it this way, a very stressful conversation. And it's the fact, as we were discussing earlier, you don't want to deny the patient or the family members that opportunity. You don't know if this is going to be their last Christmas. But at the same time, you want to protect your environment. It's kind of the principle of utilitarianism in healthcare management, that we need to protect our community. So what we have been discussing is, when patients come out, we might need to go into the same protocols as we're doing when a patient comes from the hospital. We put them in a transition unit to keep kind of an isolation process to make sure that they don't present any symptoms when they come back. I mean, you don't want to find those symptoms once they have engaged with their dynamics inside the building, spreading droplets around and putting the rest of the population at risk. So that leave of absence might have a sacrifice affiliated with it or associated with it, and it will be probably that when they come back, they might need to go into it, stay on a transitional phase, isolated from the rest of the community until we are sure that they are not infected with the virus, because we will not know where they went, who were they with, what were the precautions taken. We'll not know that. So the only way we can do is protect the rest of the community and keep those residents in transition units.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I think you would have to make sure, and tell me if I'm wrong, that the family and the residents are aware that this is going to happen after they come back, you know, because
yes.
I could see that being a real point of contention where, like,
Oh, yes.
Well, I just want to go back to my room. And I was just with my family. You know, I didn't go out the house, but you know,
it is going to be a challenge. However, as I mentioned earlier, as long as you keep the information flowing and you don't get anybody by surprise. It's like, let's say when you go to a bank and get a loan, they will tell you which are all the things that you need to pay aside from the loan if you want to get it. I mean, it's not the same scenario, but you are not upset with those costs because they're explained to you since the beginning. Does it make sense? So with the family members, if they know that by taking them out of the facility, that is going to happen when they come back. Some might say, like, okay, no problem. We'll take her. She's going to have fun with us. And then monitor her. And it's going to be 2 weeks, whatever is at the time. The worst thing that can happen is that you start telling them once they're back, like, no, you cannot leave your room because you were out. No, I mean, never do a reaction scenario. Do a proactive scenario, explaining what is going to happen, and let them take the decision. You still want to go out? Perfect. Let's work on it. That this is going to be the process, so you know what is going to follow. And it's not a threat. I mean, it is protecting everybody, and even protecting the same resident, because some other patients might do the same thing. So by doing it with the other residents, that resident is going to be protected as well. So you need to put a standard rule for everybody. And as long as you use the same rule for all the residents, you should be okay, even though, yes, it's going to be an uncomfortable process. Yes, their family members are going to be, I don't understand why you're doing this. The government already said that it's our right to go on leave of absence. Yes, it is. But still, we have the responsibility of keeping our communities as healthy as possible.
Managing your patients' needs across multiple specialties is increasingly important, but also an increasingly challenging task. U.S. Post-Acute Care now offers clinical staffing solutions not only for primary care medicine, but also for behavioral health, chronic care management, and telehealth, bringing you a more comprehensive solution for your patients and your facilities. Now more than ever, your patients need you in so many ways. Let U.S. Post-Acute Care help you deliver more complete quality care.
For more information, visit us at uspostacutecare.com.
Yeah, I think one of the unfortunate things throughout this pandemic is the misunderstanding that a lot of our patients as well as some family members have when they see some guidance come out. They assume that things are either better, safer, or not an issue any longer. And, you know, I curious to know what it's like to be in the position to then tell them, nope, we're still in it. And it's still just, we still need to adhere to these rules, even though we're allowing for the visitations, even though we're allowing mom to go home on Thanksgiving, and even though you're going out to physicians' offices. How do you deal with that when the family members are coming and being upset?
You know what? I want to say probably that had become less frequent. I think with all the information that have been flowing through the different sources, media, social media, news, the government had been doing a great job in transmitting information constantly at a county level, at a state level. I mean, I've seen our medical director for the Orange County here in Central Florida, constantly giving information out and keeping everybody updated. Since they're also hearing it from other sources, I mean, they're not getting as probably upset as they were in the beginning, in which they were, but I heard this last week, but I heard this from this other source, but this doesn't make sense, but I don't trust this X, Y, or Z source because this other source said this. I think we're getting to a point that information is getting a little bit more aligned. That is helping family members to have a little bit more of knowledge, not necessarily in medical terms, but at least in general community terms of safety and precautions. So I think that facilitates our conversation then in the facility of which protocols are we going to be following and why, because I think that is very important. It's not only telling what are you going to do, but also tell them why are you doing it. In my case, I want to say probably like 85% to 90% of the time, the family members are like, yeah, I understand. I mean, they will always try to see if they can bypass that process. But at the end, they are like, I know. So that's when you realize like, yeah, I mean, I'm also a son. I'm also a family member. I know how it feels, and it's frustrating. So that frustration, we don't want to contribute to the frustration. We want to give knowledge and see if that knowledge helps balance those emotions and make a teamwork to protect every single resident.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad to hear that it's happening in Orange County. I know there's still variability in some other counties in Florida and from around the country and other states. Let me ask you this. Have you, I don't know if you're seeing this in the facilities where you're working at, but I know that we've had concerns again about PPE shortages and, you know, lack of access to getting PPE. I think when we've asked ACA and some other resources, you know, we get the conversation, we'll make sure that they're adhering to the CARES Act. But we've seen in some recent articles, I think in the annuals of long-term care, they had an article about this within the past week, that some of the smaller facilities, some of the facilities not associated with corporate chains are now suffering again with PPE shortages. Is that something that you are seeing around the area that you guys are serving?
Here in the Charlotte County area, I haven't seen that problem as a big issue with the facilities. Most of them, they were able to work with their suppliers to keep PPE flow. Some of them actually overstock some areas in their facilities to make sure if the third wave, fourth wave, we don't know how many waves are going to come. So they have some supplies there to assist, and what they keep using it and they keep refilling to make sure that they don't go short on them anymore. I'm pretty sure around the nation there's going to be a lot of facilities, especially in the rural areas, that are going to have that shortage because, hey, PPE is not cheap. I mean, that is an investment that needs to be done, but at the same time, you cannot invest what you don't have. We know that we have our non-for-profit organizations that have facilities taking care of the underserved population sometimes. We know that there are areas that even for physicians to get there is a challenge, and that's when part of the value of telemedicine when it was authorized. So with the PPEs, that's not an exception. So with the PPEs, we know that not everybody's going to get it as accessible as other areas or as other facilities. Here, the Cherry County is kind of more of a metropolitan area. So I think that helps the distribution and the availability of the PPEs. But for sure, I'm pretty sure that is reality in many facilities in certain areas of the state and of the nation.
Have you heard of any facilities having issues with ongoing testing and the testing guidance or recommendations that CMS has put down around positivity? You know, has that become a challenge in your area or surrounding areas?
Yes, actually, it's kind of interesting because the with the change in the beginning, with I want to say probably March, April. We had the government covering the testing in the facilities through a specific lab. And so the facilities knew that it was just a path that they need to follow with the testing. Once that was over, it was kind of now what? How often? Who's going to do it? Who's going to get tested? Working with the refusal to get tested, either from residents or staff members. I mean, all that became a higher challenge once that government part was removed out of the equation. Right now, some of the facilities have partnered with specific labs that were doing their testing. And they will know that most of them are working with the cons right now. Some of the facilities are just identifying resources in the community so they can send their staff members if they need to be done at a certain time to get tested. Here in the Central Florida area, we have facilities and testing centers that the patient, name it staff member or family member, because some facilities recommend if the family member can to get tested before they come, that they don't need to pay for the test because there are some programs that they can go get tested. Still, the insurance card is taken, but they don't pay any copay, and if they don't have an insurance, they anyway get tested. So everybody's trying to identify and have a list of those options to put it in practice depending on the scenarios that they face. But with the testing, some facilities are having the challenge not only to do the test, but how often they have to do it, because like I still go to a facility that they get tested 2 times per week. So if you are going to walk into the facility, your test needs to be within 3 days of your visit to the facility. Otherwise, you cannot walk in. So each facility is following the programs with the labs that they identified. And so far, it has been flowing okay. I haven't seen like a challenge that they need to test and they cannot do it. So if one of the resources is not available, we go to the next option.
Good. My final question, and then we're going to open it up to everyone, is around the clinician's workflow and how not only are you managing, but your team's managing, given the environment that you're practicing in.
Yes. Right now is a little bit easier than I want to use the term easier, even though it's not easy, but is a little bit easier than the beginning because of all the confusion on spreading risks. We have a hospitalist division and we have a post-acute division in the company I work with. most of the hospital is saying the hospital, they don't do any kind of work in the post-acute, and most of the SNF is we do the work in post-acute, they don't do work at the hospital, but there's always isolated cases that they can moonlight at the hospital or do special work at the SNFs. In the beginning, there was a time that some of them were banned from going to the SNF because they took care of a resident with COVID in the hospital. And they had to wait 14 days and do two testing with the negative testing, those following the guidelines that were in the beginning. Right now, as long as they get tested and they wear their PPEs, even if they work with patients with COVID, as long as they keep their isolation precautions in place, they're okay to go into the facility. So it has been relaxed, still in a safe way, I want to mention. And the reason I say still in a safe way is because sometimes people are like, wait, why aren't we doing this the way we used to? I mean, it has been proven so far with the correct PPE and the precautions, the risk of transmission is extremely low. So as long as you keep track with your testing here in the Central Florida, we're still testing for every facility on a weekly basis. And that is definitely keeping us, I think, in a safe position to continue our work.
That's good to hear. I know that in the past week, we've seen that FMA put out a statement supporting physicians. And I know that around the country, there's been statements to support the nurses. Because I think it's been challenging. And mm-hmm. I don't think everyone realizes how challenging that is. So, you know, guys, I want to make sure we have time for anyone to ask questions. If you have any questions, please feel free to either put it in the chat or you could take yourself off of mute and we could definitely ask. Shane, do we have anything so far?
Yes, I have a couple in the chat. The first one from Nancy Rodriguez Weller. Any recommendations for preventative protocols for residents in long-term care? I see physicians ordering vitamin C, zinc, and adding apixaban for 1 week for residents who are COVID positive but asymptomatic.
So, Dr. Gonzalez, do you have any protocols that you're currently using?
With the medications, we are not. We are focusing on the testing and on the evaluation of possible symptoms. With the use of vitamin C and zinc, there have been advantages that have been documented so far. However, there is no final standard protocol recommended by FDA with any of the medications that are currently being tested, not even the vitamins. So if we want to go by the FDA recommendations, it's monitoring the patients and being proactive in evaluating that patient and treating accordingly. Yes, I've seen that happening, that some clinicians have been proactive and kind of starting people on the vitamins. We know that it's not going to harm to give a vitamin C, but it can give some benefit. But we also don't forget that we are monitored for unnecessary use of medications and vitamins. Sometimes they are classified as well when it comes to audits. So we need to be careful that we still need to abide by the regulations that ACA and the different regulatory agencies put the facilities through. So I would say focus on the monitoring, focus and keep an eye on your residents. Put the vitals to be done more frequently to make sure that if there's a change in temp, if the patient starts the stop and wash techniques in some of the facilities, if the patient is not eating well, if the patient is showing some changes, to notify it immediately. I mean, if we are proactive, we don't need to be adding this medications, vitamins, supplements to all the residents, just to the ones that really need it.
And I'll just add that I know when we had this conversation at our annual meeting and prior on other journal clubs, I think we had Dr. Dana Safal who was recommending or was making comment in line with what you're saying, Dr. Gonzalez, about vitamin C and zinc. I would just echo what Dr. Gonzalez said to whomever asked to Dr. Rodriguez, that you have to be very careful in the long-term care space. I think with starting medications. And if you're going to start that treatment, I would definitely make sure you have the consent of the family and you document that in your note and document what you're utilizing it for in a contingency plan, because you're going to want to make sure you're well documenting on those issues, those treatment plans that are not part or authorized to be used in this in for COVID. Any other questions, Shane?
Yes, from Jag Kattar, I apologize if I messed up your name. When and how do you plan to vaccinate your residents when the COVID vaccine is available?
Basically, as soon as it gets approved. Once it comes, we know that one of the targets of the vaccine nationwide is the more vulnerable populations, and long-term care residents are at the top of the list. So once it's approved by the FDA, that means that the safety evaluation have been passed, the effectiveness evaluation have been passed. So once we get to that stage, I feel comfortable just starting it with the residents in the facility. I know that the strategy on how that vaccination process is going to be done is still kind of a gray zone. I know that the military have been mentioned to have a team assigned to assist with that. In our annual FEMDA meeting, we had that conversation, and there are a lot of point in the flow chart that are still question marks, but I know that is in process. But the first step is waiting for the FDA to get one of the vaccines approved, and as soon as it happens, and some people ask me, are you gonna get vaccinated? I will. Once it goes through the FDA, I trust the FDA. Once it gets approved, yes, I tell everybody, I don't think we're going to get green or our ears are going to get pointy. So I'll definitely get the vaccine. I encourage all my patients to get it.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I would say, in the upcoming weeks, we will be having some of our pharmacy consultants come on to discuss how distribution will go. There is some information, I believe, on AMDA's site about getting long-term care pharmacy consultants approved to deliver the vaccination. There's a process and things that they have to do. And I believe most of the pharmacies in the state of Florida that provide pharmacy consultation to our facilities are already engaged in that process. So, you know, we're hoping to have them on either in a week or two to really go into more depth about what they know. But to Dr. Gonzalez's point, until we get approval and get some of the additional guidance on what we can do, we won't be able to share a concrete plan. There's a lot of moving parts when it comes to vaccinations because of the way the vaccine has to be stored and those things. But there are, if you've heard the plan that certain pharmacies like Walgreens and CVS were approved, there are ways for your long-term care pharmacy consultant to be approved as well.
And also we need to remember that whenever it gets approved, we still need to check on the possible side effects. We need to do disclosure of the side effects to our patients and our POAs, and they need to consent for the vaccine. We know that a lot of the vaccines, they have the Guillain-Barré risk. They have, they're not 100% safe. So we need to make sure that we have an informed consent for those vaccines, and that's not only for the COVID, but for every intervention going to do. So don't forget that still applies.
Yeah. Any other questions, Shane?
Diane?
I have no further questions in the chat.
Diane? I think Dr. Auslander has a comment.
Hi, Diane.
Hello.
Could I just follow up on the question that came up about zinc and vitamin C?
Yes, please.
Yeah, so I didn't push back when Dr. Saffel presented this. I would dare anyone to show evidence that that's effective for anything, number one. But more importantly, we are trying to emphasize deprescribing during this pandemic to minimize staff burden, staff mm-hmm. documentation, and contact with residents, and prescribing three things that are not evidence-based goes against that. I feel strongly that it shouldn't be done unless it's evidence-based. You're just putting a tremendous burden on staff that are already overstretched.
Correct.
That's my opinion.
I think that's a very great point. Yeah. And I'll add something else to Dr. Auslander's comments. You know, I think throughout this pandemic, there's been a rush to find a pill or a medication to treat it with. And I don't know if that's just us as clinicians looking and hoping for things. I think, you know, what we've learned, we've learned some very important lessons around compassionate use of medications, lessons that I would have hoped that, you know, I think there are very challenging to still process. And when we're thinking about adding things, we really have to take into consideration what we're doing, what we're treating. You know, if you're choosing to do it, please document why you're doing it, document the consents, but think about the goals of what we're trying to accomplish and the care plans for our patients. Adding more medications doesn't always help.
And I think I wanted to mention that also don't forget that we have a role as educators. There's people are looking for whatever can bring hope to the process. And if there's an extensive list of medications that are not approved for the COVID that have been mentioned that they might benefit in one of the aspects of the infection. But you're gonna hear a lot of quote unquote crazy things in the community. I've had people call me like, hey, my cousin has the COVID and she was told by a friend of hers that knows a doctor that there's a cocktail that can be given. I was like, what? So that is going to happen, but it's our duty as clinicians, as licensed clinicians in the state, to be educators of our community and make sure that they understand that nothing has been approved to be used in the setting. Everything is under investigation. Some of them are a little bit more advanced and are kind of being used in a more advanced setting, like in ICUs or inside the hospital. But community-wise, long-term care-wise, there's nothing that had been recommended to be used in our setting with the patients that we're keeping to treat in our facilities. Yeah. So not just to say no because it's no, it's just let's tell them no and let's explain them why.
Well, and I'll tell you what I told my family when they called asking about the magic cocktails. I told them the magic cocktail is to wear a mask and wash your hands. You know, I think that we have enough proof that helps, that it prevents spread.
Easier, cheaper, and available to everybody.
Mm-hmm. So if we do not have any other comments or questions, I just will thank you all for joining.
I have one more.
Oh, good, good.
From Nancy Rodriguez Weller again. Thank you. Are you finding any challenges with the dual complications of both the flu season and COVID pandemic?
Great question. The first complication that I'm foreseeing is that which came first and what are we dealing with? Whenever we have a patient with symptoms, at this point, we're going to be considering just thinking that they might have both, get them tested. And go by the results of the test and by the clinical process in the individual patient. Basically, both of them, you are very focused on symptoms. The only way you're going to differentiate some of them is in some of your patients is going to be just doing the test for both and working according to that. But as I said, you're going to treat them kind of the same way, work with the symptoms and make sure that they remain as stable as possible. And if you see any complications that goes beyond what you can treat, take the determination and they need to be admitted to the hospital or not. But yeah, the biggest challenge is going to be that it's going to be very confusing what is going on. That's why we are recommending get the flu vaccine on your residents now. Let's get that kind of out of the equation, even though you still need to keep it in mind. But let's get the vaccination for the flu, which is available, and let's keep an eye for whenever we have the COVID.
If we don't have any other questions, we'll end on that note. And I thank you guys. Look forward to chatting with you in the near future on another Journal Club. Thank you.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.